Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School in Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on hyperinflation when we come back. In Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, "By what way is it that the light is parted?" Or if we paraphrased it, it would say, "By what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated?" Now imagine asking that question 4,000 years ago. Today, of course, it's a simple question to answer, and we say, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago in Job's day? Now, when we heat a metal red hot, or we heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays of light, after passing through the spectroscope, divide themselves on a graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, we need only to pass that light ray through the spectroscope, and we can see what the composition of that star is and the proportion of each of its ingredients. This division of light rays is always constant, and it doesn't vary, and we may always rely upon the results. This spectroscopic analysis is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned or separated. Now, this places us in a quandary, because either Job knew this, or we see a supernatural wisdom being revealed here 4,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I teach here in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, and entertaining. And best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were taking a look at the Figge Report, a report put out by the Reagan administration back in the early 1980s. Harry Figge wrote up the report, put it out to the League of Women Voters, and I just have a quick observation. You have 300 million people in the United States, and in any given election, about 60 to 70 million of them vote in a national election. It should be pretty obvious to all of us by now that 70 million American voters do not comprehend, and if they do comprehend, they are unable to take action against this problem called hyperinflation. They haven't in the past. They voted it in 1913. They never in any subsequent election voted it out. Americans use credit cards, usury and interest, commercial paper, unjust weights and balances as a part and parcel of the economic system. They pay the income tax, Social Security, strictly prohibited by God in the Bible, and they seem to love it. So, as a minority, and I speak just for myself, as a very small minority of people opposed to the income tax, opposed to Social Security, opposed to interest and usury, opposed to unjust weights and balances, Federal Reserve notes, commercial paper, mortgages, banks, and bank credit cards. and I say I'm a very small minority, I don't think that I should get in the way of the majority, that is 300 million people that want to live this lifestyle and participate in this economic miracle. So, I decided to opt out. Now, the way we opt out is we go back to practicing what our founding fathers laid out for us in our Constitution, and that which is available to us every day that comes out of the United States Mint in West Point, New York, called gold and silver coin. Stay out of debt. Don't pay usury and interest. Stay out of mortgages. Stay out of stocks, bonds, and commercial paper. Practice property and property rights. And you can be a minority of one wherever you live on planet Earth. You will be practicing the Mosaic Law. And as a result of that, you'll get the benefits that come from it. And you can avoid the curses that come from the impending hyperinflation and collapse of the world's economy. It's a choice that you need to make, and it's a choice that indeed Americans have made, past tense. It's already a done deal. We don't have to talk about, if we don't do this, here's what's going to happen. The answer is, we had our opportunity. We did not take any affirmative action. Indeed, we took every negative action possible. And like the Titanic, we're not talking about what would happen if we hit an iceberg. We've already hit the iceberg. The ship is already ripped open. This ship is going to sink. What we don't know is, when is it going to sink? And right now, Americans are lined up at the rail, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee, having a good time with their banter, wondering when all of this commotion is going to subside. And a few of us are standing around wondering, when does the rush to the lifeboats begin? So before the rush begins, it would be wise, in my view, to go get seated in a lifeboat right now, before the rush begins. Because once the rush begins, there will not be room for everybody. You see, not everybody can get all of their assets secured when the rush begins. Let me give you a quick illustration. Many people in America have gold. They don't have physical possession of gold, but they do have gold. They have bought gold, and they own pieces of paper, and they have their gold on deposit over here in a depository. Now, the problem with that is that the amount of gold that is in these pieces of paper, and the pieces of paper should represent the physical gold in the depositories. That is, for every piece of paper representing an ounce of gold, there should be a physical ounce of gold in these depositories. Now, here's the secret that nobody knows about. If you take the total pieces of paper and you compare it to the total ounces of gold in the depositories, they are 15 years short. Now, the world's gold production is 2,500 tons a year times 15 years. That's 37,500 tons. So if you take all of the pieces of paper that have been written between 1971 and 2006, they represent 37,500 tons of gold, for which it is not dug out of the ground yet. Now, it is true that there is a bunch of gold in the vaults and in the repositories, and if you had some pieces of paper that said, pay to the bearer 1,000 ounces today, you could go get your 1,000 ounces. Now, there are millions of people like you that have those pieces of paper that say, you have this gold on deposit in these repositories. When it becomes obvious that this ship is going to sink, then all of those people will be rushing to the repositories to get their 1,000 ounces of gold. You don't have to have a degree in economics to figure out that when you have 37,500 tons of gold that is going to be demanded, and you have virtually zero in the vaults. Somebody isn't going to get their share. Silver is in the same boat, and we're beginning to see this with zinc, copper, and nickel. The physical inventories and the amount that has been sold, past tense, don't match. That's the bottom line. Now, if you take all of the dollars that are in circulation, you know, you just take a look at your bank deposit. And let's say, for the sake of our discussion here, that you've got $7,000 in the bank. Now, you say to yourself, I've got $7,000 in the bank. And you know what a dollar will buy. And so you know, in your mind, about how much you can spend at Walmart. You know that when you walk into the Walmart store with your checkbook that you can buy $7,000 worth of goods. And you can see that this Walmart store has literally millions of dollars worth of goods on the shelf. Now, there are 300 million Americans, of which about 100 million are workers, wage earners, and heads of family. So 100 million of you have $7,000 in the bank. Now, each and every one of you knows that individually you can walk into any Walmart store any day of the week with your checkbook and your $7,000 and walk out with $7,000 worth of tennis shoes, big screen TVs, and groceries. And you're not at all concerned. And I'm telling you that as long as the system goes on the way it is, there is nothing for you to be concerned about. But you should be aware that you and 100 million other Americans with $7,000 in the bank, if you all go down to the Walmart stores and the Target stores and the Big K stores and the gas stations, and you all tomorrow, all at the same time, write out your checks and say, good, now give me my $7,000 worth of goods off the shelf. There's exactly 2% of that amount on the shelves, in the warehouses, and available for you to buy and take home. Now that means that today you can go down and get your whole $7,000. But if you wait until the rush comes on, and everybody goes to the store at the same time, and assuming that it's all divided up equally, you'll walk out with 2%. So take your $7,000 times 0.02, and you will collect $140 out of your $7,000 worth of claim checks. That's what you're actually going to take home. And you can rest assured, that if you don't get there to get your share, you're not even going to get your $140. So a lot of people are going to get the whole $7,000, and a lot of people are going to get $6,000, $5,000, $2,000, $1,000, $500, and $400, and then some people will get $140, and then everybody else will get zero. So put that in your pipe, smoke it up a little bit, inhale deeply, and if you enjoy it, that's great. Now let the buyer beware. Now, there was a lady in Germany in 1923 who was broke, but she had one asset, and she needed to sell it, and that was her home. Now, when she sold her home in January of 1923, she sold it for 15 billion marks. Now, that's about the equivalent of you selling your home for $15 billion. People today are mesmerized by the big numbers that they're seeing the values of their house. Now, it isn't that your house is worth more money, it's that your money is worth less. That's the bottom line. That house that you bought 30 years ago for $40,000 is worth less than $40,000 because the termites have been eating on it and the roof needs to be replaced. But it's priced at $340,000. Well, this lady had a house priced at 15 billion marks, and she sold it in January of 1923. By July of 1923, 15 billion marks would buy one loaf of bread. Now, that's hyperinflation. That's what's coming. So get ready. Now, since hyperinflation is visible as a monetary effect, models of hyperinflation center on the demand for money, and economists see both a rapid increase in the money supply and an increase in the velocity of money. Either one or both of these scenarios encourage inflation, which eventually turns into hyperinflation. A dramatic increase in the velocity of money as the cause of hyperinflation is central to the crisis of confidence model of hyperinflation, where the risk premium that sellers demand for the paper currency over the nominal value grows rapidly. In fact, it grows daily. The second theory is that there is first a radical increase in the amount of circulating medium, which can be called the monetary model of hyperinflation. In either one of these two models, the second effect then follows from the first, either too little confidence forcing an increase in the money supply, or too much money, which destroys all confidence. In the confidence model, some event or series of events, such as defeats on the battlefield, or a run on stocks of the specie, which would be a run on gold and silver, which may either back the currency or something that we believe backs the currency, removes the belief that the authority, the Federal Reserve in this case, which is issuing the money, will remain solvent. So whether a bank or a government, because people do not want to hold notes which may become valueless, they want to spend them in preference to holding notes which are losing their value. So let me break in here. American money, that is U.S. dollars, are losing their purchasing power at the rate of 11% a year, 10.9. $100 that you're holding in your wallet today, next year at this time, is going to buy $90 worth of goods. That being the case, wouldn't you be better advised to take the $100 today, go down to the store and convert that to pinto beans at 40 cents a pound? Let me see how many beans you can get. $100 divided by 0.40 is 250 pounds of beans. So if you take the $100 down today and you trade it in, you're going to get 250 pounds of beans. Now let's put 10% price inflation on those beans, and if they're 40 cents today times 0.10, we're going to have to add 4 cents, so next year they're going to be 44 cents a pound. Okay, so let's take the same $100 bill, and let's divide that by 0.44, and we're going to get 227 pounds of beans. So by holding the $100 bill from now until next year at this time, we're going to lose 23 pounds of beans. 23 pounds. So if we hold that $100 bill for 2 years and we have 10% inflation compounded, we're going to lose more than 23 pounds the following year. It's 23 pounds plus 10%, which is 2.3 pounds, or add 3 pounds to that, and we're going to lose about 26 pounds. 26 plus the 22 that we've lost already, or the, 22, or 227 pounds of beans, and the next year we're going to lose another 23 pounds, and so on. As we hold this piece of paper, we are losing pounds of beans. Now, at this moment in time, the average Joe six-pack, he doesn't see that and he doesn't recognize that. He still has confidence in his dollars. He has confidence in his money. When he wakes up to that fact, which even the dullards among us with IQs of around 75, 80, 85, or 90 will wake up to at some point in time, there becomes a great rush for people to go convert that paper into something. And that's what takes all of the goods off the shelves very rapidly. And then all of a sudden, the shelves at Walmart are bare. Bare. Now, in the past, we have always relied upon Walmart to go over to China and to buy more goods and put it back on the shelf. Now, you see, the Chinese have a problem. The Chinese, for many years now, have been taking our paper. In fact, they're holding around $337 billion worth of that paper. They have claims in their possession that if, all things being equal, they could come over here to America with their $337 billion and they could buy the Unocal Oil Company for about $20 billion. And they wanted to do that. They said, here's our $20 billion, we want to buy that oil company. Kind of like playing Monopoly. And the American Congress said, no way, Jose, you've got the paper and we owe you the money and we don't deny it, but you can't buy. You cannot buy, we will not sell to you the oil company. So the Chinese then say, well, what can we buy? And the answer is, well, you can buy trips to Disneyland, or you can buy trips to Disney World, or Six Flags, or you can spend your money in a whole host and plethora of other ways, but you can't buy Harley-Davidson motorcycles, Caterpillar tractors, or oil companies. All right, let's put that into perspective. Let's suppose that you've got $7,000 in the bank. And you walk into Walmart and you say, I've got $7,000 worth of claim checks. And along with your $7,000 in claim checks, a whole bunch of other people have $7,000 in claim checks. And you walk in and you say, I want to buy $7,000 worth of pinto beans. Now, it just so happens that the Walmart store has a lot of pinto beans. And maybe they've even got $7,000 worth, but there are a lot of other people that are asking for $7,000 worth of pinto beans. And the Walmart store, while they've got a lot of pinto beans, they don't have $7,000, $14,000, $21,000, $28,000, or $35,000 worth of pinto beans, and so we have to have rationing. And that's what we had in World War II. For those of you old-timers that can remember World War II in Korea, we had rationing. So the government comes in and they say, okay, you are now rationed. You are limited. You can only have 1 pound of butter a month. You can have 1 pound of meat per person per month. You can have so many pounds of pinto beans per month, so many packages of cigarettes per month, so many ounces of pepper per month, and so on. And so they put in a great big system of rationing. With ration cards and buttons and whistles and bells and forms and coupons and things to fill out. And we stand in line to get our fair share. That's what communism produces. Communism is the system where you stand in line and share the shortage. We Americans adopted communism back in 1913 with the adoption of our Federal Reserve Bank, which was the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, which was then enacted into law. And in 1916, we took on an institution called the IRS, and we instituted the income tax, which is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. Then in 1935, we adopted the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto, which is called Social Security. And then in 1937, the tenth plank, which is called Free Education for All Children in Public Schools. And then we abolished the right to private property, and so on, and we adopted all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And that's why we're about to get the rewards that come from communism. And that's where you stand in line to share the shortage. In the past, we did not stand in line, and we shared the abundance based upon property and property rights, the Ten Commandments, and Thou Shalt Not Steal. Now we're going to share the shortage under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. It's a choice that we had to make, and it's a choice that we've already made past tense. It's not something that we need to be concerned about, or that we have to do something to take some kind of action to save our economy, or to save America, or to prevent the catastrophe that is impending. The catastrophe is going to occur, and it's going to occur to you in a city near you very shortly. Now, that having been said, in the confidence model, some event or series of events, such as defeats in battle, a defeat in Iraq, which is impending, boys and girls. A military defeat in Iraq is pending. And incidentally, the national budget is out of balance in excess of $500 billion a year. And the balance of payments deficit is in excess, it's out of balance in excess of $550 billion a year. These excesses that we have been engaged in over the last 10 to 15 years are now to such a size, the size of these debts and deficits is so great, we are approaching the time when we can no longer service the interest on those debts. That's what we call a default. Default. And when you default, that is, you fail to make a payment on time, on schedule, then your creditor gets real nervous real fast. And the Chinese and the Japanese and the Saudis and the other oil-producing countries of the world can see that for their oil they get pieces of paper, and that they're very unlikely to be at any time in the near future able to convert those pieces of paper into oil companies or Caterpillar tractors or into pinto beans. Now, when that happens, the model that we have watched over the years is that your creditors quit lending to you. They will not give you any more pinto beans. They won't sell you any more oil. You will be on a COD basis. That's called cash on delivery. If you want our oil, you pay for it. And you have to pay for it with Caterpillar tractors. You have to pay for it with gold or silver or wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. Now, we have a standard of living here in America, and we're very comfortable with it. We go down to the Walmart store, and we fill up our baskets, and we wheel them out of there, and we just buy any and everything we want to. There's no rationing. We can buy all the pinto beans we want. And we love it. Now, we're buying $750 billion a year worth of goods overseas, and we're selling $200 to these people. So you take 750 and then you take away 200, and then that leaves you 550 billion. Okay? Now, here's what this boils down to. Last week you went into the Walmart store and you filled up your basket and you drove out of the Walmart store and you're happy as a clam at high tide. The difference between 550 and 750. So we take 550 and divide that by 750. And that's 73%. 73%. Now, next week, when you walk into the Walmart store, what's going to happen is, instead of getting 100% of what you want, you're going to walk out of there with about 27% of what you want. That's the ultimate end of this. Which means you're going to take a hit in your standard of living of 73%. Now, I submit to you, boys and girls, when you find that you can buy everything that you want today, and tomorrow you go into the store and you can get 27% of what you want, roughly a fourth, you're going to take a big hit in your standard of living. That's a big hit. Because that's what the numbers tell us. Boys and girls, I would submit to you that you will see rioting in the streets if your standard of living took a 10% hit. If you people walked into the Walmart store and you couldn't get 100% of everything you want, you could only get 90%, you people would be so ticked off. You would vote the Republicans out of office. You would riot in the streets with 10%. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, economists on the conservative side are telling us that the situation is so dire that it is not salvageable. You can't salvage this economy. This thing is toast. It's already a done deal. Now, in 1979, the chairman of the Federal Reserve was a great big monster of a man named Paul Volcker. He introduced a bitter pill called 21% interest. Can you remember that? 21% interest. And it was so big a pill that you people voted Jimmy Carter out of office. Now, the big pill that we swallowed in 1980, 21% interest, was caused by Richard Nixon in the closing of the gold window, and you took it out on Jimmy Carter, who didn't have anything to do with that problem. Nothing. Zero. He wasn't in office. But by 1980, when you people were suffering from unemployment, and you had 21% interest, and the housing market had collapsed, and you had high unemployment rates, you voted him out. Well, you're going to do the same thing. But when you vote the next guy in, like you did in 1980, you voted Ronald Reagan in. And Ronald Reagan, if you'll remember, said, okay, Mr. Grace, tell us what the answer to the riddle is. And Mr. Grace came back and said, we can solve this problem. And President Reagan said, well, we don't want to solve the problem. So why don't you just go right on back home? Now, Mr. Grace turned it over to Mr. Figge. Mr. Figge went out on the stump and he said, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you the answer to the riddle. Mr. Figge told us the answer to the riddle. But you see, the powers that are in possession of CBS, NBC, and ABC are the same bankers that gave us the problem to start with. And you people get your news and your information from ABC, CBS, Time, and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report. And so you don't see this side of the story that you would be getting if you subscribe to the International Forecaster or the Privateer or the Money Changer or any of the hundreds of newsletters that are out there. And as a result, when this event transpires, it will be a shock. It will be a surprise. Everyone will be wondering what happened. Why was it that nobody could see this coming? Why didn't anybody tell us? Now, that's the results of public school. Now, often by issuing a completely new currency, you know, under this model, the method of ending hyperinflation is to change the backing of the currency or to change the currency. Now, when we look at Revelation 13:16, we see that there is a new currency coming. And we saw it from George Orwell. And we have heard it from the New World Order gang. And they said, we're going to have a cashless society. We're going to have a new world order, a one world government headed by the United Nations with a world taxing system and a world army. And that this world system is going to occupy for a short period of time power and control over the world. It is going to be such a dictatorship, such an onerous dictatorship, such a ghastly dictatorship, that they are going to destroy approximately 9/10 of humanity in the process. And in Matthew 24, the Messiah, this is Jesus of Nazareth, you know, sweet Jesus, away in the manger, said that if he didn't come back to intervene, that the ensuing wars and the economic debacle and the death and destruction, the famine, the starvation that's going on, that if he didn't return and cut it short, no flesh would be saved alive on planet Earth. And he said, not even from the days of Noah to this time has there ever been something like it, and there never will be again. He said that it would be worse than Noah's flood. Hyperinflation. That's today's topic. Hang on, let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, war is one commonly cited cause of a crisis of confidence, particularly losing a war, such as we're about to do in Iraq. As occurred during the Napoleonic Vienna and Capital Flight, sometimes because of contagion is another. In this view, the increase in the circulating medium is the result of the government attempting to buy time without coming to terms with the root cause of the lack of confidence itself. Now, in the monetary model, hyperinflation is a positive feedback cycle of rapid monetary expansion. It has the same cause as all other inflation. It's the money-issuing body, whether it's a central bank or something else, that produces currency to pay spiraling costs, often from lax fiscal policy or the mounting costs of a war. When business people perceive that the issuer of the money is committed to a policy of rapid currency expansion, such as we see in the United States today, they mark up prices to cover the expected decay in the currency's value over the short term. The issuer then must then accelerate its expansion of money production to cover these higher prices anticipated by the businessmen who consistently push their prices higher and higher, which then in turn pushes the currency value down faster and faster, which then causes price acceleration faster and faster, which then causes the production of paper faster and faster, and then according to this model, the issuer cannot win, which then leaves only the solution to abruptly stop expanding the currency. Unfortunately, the end of expansion can cause a severe financial shock to those using the currency as expectations are suddenly readjusted. This policy, combined with reductions of pensions, wages, and government outlays, formed part of the Washington Consensus of the 1990s. Now, whatever the cause, hyperinflation involves both the supply and the velocity of money. Now, which comes first is a matter of debate, and there may be no universal story that applies to every case historically. But once these hyperinflations become established, the pattern of increasing the money supply by which ever agencies are allowed to do so is universal. And when it occurs, it will occur worldwide because all of the nations of the world are tied to the United States dollar as the reserve currency. Now, because this practice increases the supply of currency without any matching increase in demand for the currency, or an increase in the supply of pinto beans or other goods and services, the price of the currency, that is, the exchange rate, naturally falls relative to the other currencies. Inflation then becomes hyperinflation when the increase in the money supply turns specific areas of pricing power into a general frenzy of spending, spending quickly before the money becomes worthless. The purchasing power of the currency drops so rapidly that holding cash for even a day is an unacceptable loss of purchasing power. So as a result, no one holds the currency, which increases the velocity of money and then worsens the crisis. That is, rapidly rising prices undermine money's role as a store of value, so the people try to spend the money on real goods or services as quickly as possible. Thus, the monetary model predicts that the velocity of money will rise rapidly as a result of the excessive increase in the money supply. At the point where ordinary purchases are affected by inflation pressures, hyperinflation then is called out of control, in the sense that ordinary policy mechanism, such as increasing reserve requirements or raising interest rates or cutting government spending, will all be responded to by shifting away from the rapidly dwindling currency and towards some other means of exchange, such as cigarettes or whiskey, or cows, horses, beans, and wheat. During a period of hyperinflation, bank runs loans for 24-hour periods, switching to alternate currencies, and the return to use of gold and silver or even barter becomes very common. Many of the people who hoard gold today expect hyperinflation, and they are hedging against this hyperinflation by holding specie. There is also extensive capital flight or flight to a hard currency, such as the U.S. dollar. These are sometimes met with capital controls, which is an idea which has swung from standard to anathema and back into semi-respectability. All of this constitutes an economy which is operating in an abnormal way, which may lead to decreases in real production. And if that happens, that intensifies the hyperinflation, since it means that the amount of goods or the amount of pinto beans available to buy in too much money chasing too few goods, the formulation then is also reduced. Prices go up because there's an actual shortage of supply. This is also part of the vicious cycle of hyperinflation. Once the vicious cycle of hyperinflation has been ignited, dramatic policy means are almost always required. Simply raising interest rates is totally insufficient. Bolivia, for example, underwent a period of hyperinflation in 1985, where prices increased 12,000% in the space of 1 year. The government raised the price of gasoline, which it had been selling at a huge loss, to quiet popular discontent. And the hyperinflation came to a halt almost immediately, since it was able to bring in hard currency by selling its oil abroad. The crisis of confidence ended. The people returned deposits to banks. The German hyperinflation of the 1920s was ended by producing a currency based on assets loaned against by banks called the Rentenmark. Hyperinflation often ends when a civil conflict ends with one side winning. Though sometimes used, wage and price controls to control or prevent inflation, no episode of hyperinflation has been ended by the use of price controls alone, though they have sometimes been part of a mix of policies used to halt hyperinflation. So you can expect that at some point in time you're going to have ration cards. Now, that tells you then that you ought to have a 4-year supply of just about everything that you can think of that you want to use over the next 4 years to maintain your standard of living. For instance, There was a story years ago, Johnny Carson, you know, who was our late night talk show host, and one night old Carson comes on and he says, "Hey, have you heard about the shortage of toilet paper?" And he had a little skit, and he talked about the shortage of toilet paper. Now, about 13 million people watched Johnny every night. And a lot of those people believed the skit was true, and that there was, in fact, a shortage of toilet paper. Now, when 13 million people believe that there's a shortage of toilet paper, the next morning, those 13 million people all went out to the supermarkets, and they cleaned the shelves coast to coast and border to border of toilet paper, which did, in fact, produce a real shortage of toilet paper. Because, you see, the other 100 million people that didn't watch Carson didn't know that there was a toilet paper shortage, and they didn't go out and buy any toilet paper. So when they went into the store to buy their weekly allotment of toilet paper, the shelves were bare. And it caused quite a sensation. Because the truth of the matter is there wasn't any shortage. There was plenty being produced. But you see, once people perceive that there is a shortage, they will go in and they will buy up whatever's there. And it will indeed create a shortage. I remember in 1964, we had a flood in Humboldt County. Knocked out all the bridges, and there was only one road into the area. So all traffic was halted. And the civil defense people, using this one road, where it now took about 14 hours to run a truck from San Francisco, 275 miles to Eureka, California, through this one-lane road. You know, this road was just a one-way road. It was Highway 1 up to Fort Bragg, and then from Fort Bragg they had to come up over the mountains through these county roads. And it took about 14 hours to get up there, and of course there was no cars on the road, but just trucks. And so the civil defense people said, "Listen, there's no problem. We'll get all of our supplies in here by truck, and it'll take us about 3 or 4 days to get things back to normal. So just continue buying like you always have. Don't panic. Don't hoard. Don't go out and panic buy." And you know what the people did? Immediately, the people went to the stores and cleaned the shelves. Well, I was living on the Rocha Ranch at that time and milking cows and doing my thing. And one day, while this was going on, we were busy cleaning up, you know, after the flood. We got flooded out. And so we're busy cleaning up and doing our thing. And one day, it was Sunday or something like that, we said, "Well, we had a couple hours off, so let's go to town." So we went to town, and while we were there, I said, "Let's go into the Purity store." So we went into the Purity store, and here's the supermarket, and I walked into the supermarket, and it was bare. And there were about 6 employees in the store. This was on a Sunday. And these 6 employees were all up at the cash registers, the stock clerks and the cash register guys, and I guess the manager was there. And the store was open. I don't know why. There wasn't anything to sell, but the store was open. And I shouldn't say there wasn't anything to sell, because as I went in the store and I walked around a little bit, there was hominy. You know, now that's, you know, in Yankee land, hominy isn't very, very popular. And there were a few other things in there, you know, that were on the shelf, you know, such as, you know, black-eyed peas maybe and a couple other things. But there was no meat, there was no milk, there was no cheese, no ketchup, no Tabasco sauce. Everything's cleared off the shelves. So I walked up and I said, "What in the hell went on here? What happened? I've never seen anything like this before." And this guy said to me, he said, "Well, on Friday, the civil defense people said, don't hoard, don't panic. Everything's under control." And he said within hours, people came into the store, and the first thing they hit was the meat. People came up here with shopping carts, just loaded up with meat. That's all they had in there was meat. So it didn't take very long until the store was cleaned out of meat. Then after the meat was gone, then the next thing they hit was the milk, cheese, butter, eggs, all the dairy products. They loaded up their carts. So here comes people up here, and they've got they've got cheese and milk and butter and eggs, and they might buy 30, 40 pounds of butter and 20 dozen eggs, and so they hauled all of that out. Then the people descended on the canned goods, and so they'd come in here and they had all of the spinach and all of the peas and all of the green beans and so on. And he said, you know, the crazy thing was, he said, the people with the meat didn't have any beans to go with it and didn't have any A1 sauce to put on it, but they had the meat. And then the next guy, he comes up here and he's got all the A1 sauce and the ketchup and the mustard, but he hasn't got any meat to put it on. And then the next gang comes up here and they've got butter and eggs and milk and but they don't have any meat and they don't have any potatoes and they don't have any vegetables. And he said it was pandemonium all day Friday, all day Saturday, and we were cleaned out by Saturday afternoon, and we're not expecting a truck in until tomorrow morning, which is Monday. Well, I learned a lesson from that, kids. I said, oh, okay. I see how this works. You need a minimum 1 year supply of food on your shelf in your pantry forever. You need a 2 year supply of food on your shelves in case there's a real problem. You need a 3 year supply of food on your shelves so that you can comply with the year of release and the jubilee. And in case we have a debacle like a loss in a war or a hyperinflation or a combination of the two, before this thing is straightened out and back to normal, you might need a 4 year supply. Sometimes people ask me, how come you got a 4 year supply? And I said, because the book of Revelation tells us very plainly that we're going to suffer from 1,260 days, 3.5 years. 3.5 years is about 1,260 days. Allow yourself 3 months going in and 3 months going out, and that's about 4 years. That's about how long wars last. Now, World War II, about 4 years. World War I, about 4 years. The war in Vietnam, a little longer than that. And the war in Iraq, you know, we're in our fourth year. Now, the war in Iraq is going very poorly. And in the final analysis, Americans have not got the stomach to stick out that war for 10 or 15 years, which is going to be required if you want to win. Americans don't mind winning in 90 days, but if it takes 9 years, we're not interested in that. So you can rest assured that the war in Iraq is lost. Not because the enemy can defeat us on the battlefield, but because Americans do not have the will to stick it out. And if you don't have the will to stick it out, you can't win. And you can rest assured that your enemies over there have the will to stick it out. There was a Vietnamese general. His name is General Giap. G-I-A-P, I believe it was. General Giap. And he was on a talk show. He was being interviewed. I don't know if it was a talk show, but it was an interview. And the interviewer pointed out to General Giap that in the entirety of the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong had never won a single battle in the entire war. And the general leaned forward and he said, but we won the war. And it's our troops that are occupying Saigon. Now, boys and girls, in the Revolutionary War, the American forces only won one battle. General George Washington, the father of our country, the general who led our forces through the Revolutionary War for 7 or 8 years, from 1776 to 1783, only won one single battle. He won the one battle that counted, the Battle of Yorktown. You see, children, the English did not have what it took to stick it out. If push came to shove, and the English had stayed in the fight, the ultimate end of the Revolutionary War would have been that the English would have won that war. And if the Americans had stuck it out in Vietnam, The ultimate end of the Vietnam War would have been America would have won, hands down. But the English gave up and quit after Yorktown, and the Americans gave up and quit in Vietnam. And America will give up and quit in Iraq. That's the bottom line. And that's the stuff of the economic collapse. In the same way that it's the stuff of the sinking of the Titanic when you're sailing the ship at 23 knots straight into 5,000 square miles of icebergs, hoping that the ship will always be occupying space occupied by water and not ice. And in theory, that's possible, but it's not very likely. Possible, but not likely. So I think that for the minority of us, you know, we can sit back and we can say, we're not going to overturn the Federal Reserve or the income tax. We're not going to change the course of the Federal Reserve policy on money or the Congress of the United States or the President of the United States or the course of the war in Iraq. Little people like us driving trucks and shuttling the kids off to the soccer games are not the people that make those kinds of policy decisions. And we oftentimes get hurt by the policy decisions. In World War II, us little guys got hurt by having to go to the store, and we were limited to 1 pound of meat a month. We got hurt when we went to the store, and we were limited to 1 pound of sugar per month. It would seem like to me that if you put away 1,000 or 2,000 pounds of sugar today, you wouldn't be limited to 1 pound a month next year, the year after, or the year after that. Just something to consider. Now, this hyperinflation, as noted in countries experiencing hyperinflation, the central bank often prints money in larger and larger denominations as the smaller denomination notes become worthless. This can result in production of some interesting banknotes, including those denominated in amounts of $1 billion or more. Now, so far in America, we're not there yet. We are not printing bills in excess of $100. Now, watch when they start printing $500 and $1,000 bills. As your $1, $5, and $10 bills become less and less significant in your purchases and transactions. And as your houses become worth $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, $1 billion, and $15 billion. But as the hyperinflation accelerates, the $15 billion house today, 6 months from now, the $15 billion that you receive for the house will be worth about one loaf of bread. And that's how you get robbed of your wealth. It's just taxed away by your government. And it's called inflation. As the Mogambo said, we are freaking doomed. Well, we're about out of time, so let's wrap it up for today. And let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information, go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.